And are they one and the same? Are they different?
The Buddha doesn't talk that much about unselfishness. I mean, he does talk about compassion. But you have to remember that given the principle of karma, when you do something good for other people, you're going to benefit.
Right.
And when you do something good for yourself, other people will benefit as well, if it's really genuine doing good.
So our understanding of unselfishness needs to be adjusted.
Yeah.
Very good. And then also giving in relationship to the to greed, the poison.
Okay, that's definitely, this is a good antidote to greed.
Okay. A prime anecdote?
It's
or
the basic,
a good
it's
one?
The basic one. It's the basic
one. It's the basic one. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Passage 31 before we go on to the next topic. This is basically the three factors of the donor, the three factors of the recipient that make a gift bear great fruit. The three factors of the donor, that you're before giving you're glad, while giving your mind is bright and clear, and after giving you're gratified, you feel happy. Now this sounds like the responsibility of the donor, and it is, but it's also the responsibility of the recipient. You know, once you receive something, you want to make sure that the donor stays glad that they gave it to you. You don't want to abuse their generosity, because that would spoil the quality of their generosity. Secondly, for the factors of the recipient, the recipients are free from passion or practicing for the subduing of passion, free of aversion or practice for the subduing of aversion, free of delusion or practicing for the subduing of delusion. Again, on the one hand, this is the responsibility of the recipient to be practicing this way. But also, if, you know, for a donor who wants to give, you look around, well, who's actually practicing this way? Those are people that I would want to benefit. So it's kind of a mutual responsibility between the donor and the recipient for making sure that the gift bears great fruit for the donor. Question over here.
Namely, gratitude, which is, there's a sutta about it and something like that. I wonder whether it's late or early, where it divides it into two things. One thing is you acknowledge you received a benefit, and number two, you return in kind or spread it around. It's like that, like metta. It's one of those Buddha things that's contagious. Is that earlier or is that later?
Well, they have two terms that both tend to be translated as gratitude, katanyu, which means having a sense of what was given, literally. That you realize I benefited from this person's gift, so I received this gift, and so I appreciate that. And gatawaiti would be the real feeling of gratitude then. In a sense, okay, feeling gratitude, what do? You repay the debt, or if the person is not there to repay, you pass it on. And it's a very subtle distinction, and the texts don't really explain it that clearly. So you have to ask a native speaker, and there are no native speakers around anymore. So it's kind of guesswork as to what the division is between the two terms.
Native speaker of what?
Pali.
Oh, you're a native speaker, right?
I'm not a native speaker of Pali.
It's like Latin,
if you're
a priest.
No. Priests are not native speakers of Pali. Yeah.
Is it considered, is the Buddha actually said that, or is it like one of those?
It's one of the early sutras.
Like early, ETB.
ETB.
Early Buddhist teaching.
BT, okay. Question in the back.
I have it's a lesson of generosity that I am over the past 10 years have been looking at and learning through, and maybe it was more than 10 years ago. My husband and I gave a large loan to somebody so that they could go to college, with the understanding we would be paid back. But it was a gift. So the recipient did not then
pay back.
Well, yeah, it became a problem. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, they gradually, you know, a little, they came to an understanding that month to month she would pay back. And it became increasingly not comfortable. And there would be months it didn't happen. So then a couple of months ago, I gave another gift, half of it. So half of it was paid back. And so I gave another gift, which was loan forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And deciding to give the loan forgiveness was twofold. One, I wanted to be released of that burden. Mm-hmm. And it was going to release the recipient of that burden. And yet I feel freer. Mm-hmm. and there's still a something around it.
Right.
It was the better of the not good choices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd say, okay, learn how to appreciate, okay, I had them enough money so I could actually make that gift and be done with it. And appreciate that fact. And it's at the very least, okay, I'm going to get that money back in a future lifetime. At the very least.
Thank you.
I mean, being reborn among the four great kings is not bad. Okay, let's move on to renunciation. We've got an hour to do four. So it's 15 minutes per perfection. Okay, renunciation. This is part of our resolve. And it should be seen as generosity. It's a trade, it's not a deprivation. And the question is, what are you renouncing? Renouncing sensuality. Very early on, I was doing a survey of some American Buddhist books. I looked into the index to see what they had to say about renunciation, and of course, very few of them had anything to say. There was one book that said you have to learn how to renounce unhealthy relationships, and another one said you should learn how to renounce your controlling mindset. Now, you don't need the Buddha to tell you those things. Your parents will tell you, get out of bad relationships. Your psychotherapist will tell you, stop your controlling mindset. The Buddha is talking about sensuality. And what he means by sensuality is not sensual pleasures, it's our fascination with thinking about them. Planning for them, you know. When I leave this retreat, I'm going to go and have a pizza, and it's going to be at this pizza parlor, and I'm going to put these toppings on it, and it's going to be really good. No, wait a minute, I'd rather have those pizza toppings. And you could think about this for hours. And you eat the pizza, it's what, 15 minutes? And then after the pizza's done, wasn't that a great pizza? And you can talk about the pizza, how great it was, and get yourself primed for the next pizza. That's sensuality. That's what the Buddha's talking about. And then learning how to renounce that is going to be an important part of the practice. Because the Buddha's not saying that all pleasures of the flesh are bad. It's the pleasure that comes from seclusion, the pleasure that's based on harmony, and the pleasure that's based on basic health. Remember what we talked about, using the requisites, and that you do use the requisites for the sake of your health and for the sake of your well-being. That's perfectly okay. But it's this fascination we have with going over and over and over what a sensual pleasure is going to be, and then after it's done, sort of elaborating for ourselves. That's the way the mind sets itself up to go for it again, basically. You know, all the magazines about wine, gourmet magazine. I mean, you sit there and you're not eating anything, but you're salivating, you know. That's the kind of thing the Buddha's talking about. And by engaging in sensuality like that, we're priming ourselves to be, say, well, if I'm going to be happy, I have to have this, 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 and this particular sensual pleasure. You're placing yourself in a position of weakness. In order to be happy, I've got to have things just so. Whereas if you're not contemplating or you're not fascinated with that stuff all the time, then you find that you do have more time, more energy for things that are actually more beneficial. And we were commenting yesterday on how the Theravada list of the perfections does not include the practice of jhana or right concentration. I think it comes in here, because as the Buddha said, you're not going to be able to overcome your attachment to sensuality unless you have an alternative pleasure, which is not sensual, i.e., at the very least, the first jhana. You can understand the drawbacks of sensuality, that it puts you in this position of weakness, you're dependent on other people for your happiness. When you have something, other people will be jealous of you. When I was in France a couple months back, I was mentioning what they call the BMW chill. Do you remember those commercials? This guy comes up to the top of a parking garage, and there are these ordinary cars, but they're his BMWs right there. And he gets this chill, you know. And you want to shoot him. But that's what they're selling you. They're selling you the sensuality. They're not selling you the car. They're selling you this fascination around, you know, who I am because I have a BMW and all that other stuff that comes around the consumption of sensual pleasures. And Buddha says you can think about the drawbacks. You know, if you do get a BMW, somebody might key it. Nobody keys a old Nissan Sentra, but if you get a BMW, watch out. So you think about all the drawbacks of all these things. But he says, you can think about these drawbacks, but you still go for it because you don't have an alternative. This is why you have to practice concentration. You learn how to meditate so you can give rise to a sense of well-being by the way you breathe. Like we did yesterday, working with the breath energies in the body, that gives you a sense of pleasure inside that is not sensual. It's physical, but it's not sensual. There's a distinction. And it's in this way you can start pulling yourself away from your fascination with that kind of thing. And in that way, that becomes the perfection of sensuality. Remember the Buddha on his course toward his awakening, he had that vision of the lumber that was in water and was full of sap, and then the lumber that was out of the water but still full of sap, and then there was the lumber that was totally dry. And it's only the lumber that's totally dry that gives rise to a good fire. So in this way, he saw that, okay, if you're indulging in sensual pleasures all the time and your mind has a sap of sensuality, it's not going to have the fire. You can't set fire to your mind. Even if you take it out of the enjoyment of sensual pleasures, but you still have the sensuality, it still can't set fire to it. You have to get it dry. He thought that meant that you have to go totally without any pleasure at all, which was a mistake. And the way you get out of that is to find an alternative pleasure, which would be the alternative, the pleasure of jhana, pleasure of concentration. So that's quick. Well, you know, he had the vision of the wood outside of the water with no sap. He thought that meant that the only thing he could think of, the only alternative to sensual pleasure would be pain. And that was the mistake. That's when he realized, okay, there is an alternative pleasure which is not sensual pleasure, which is part of the path. That would be the correct interpretation of that image.
Who was this amazing state?
The Buddha, on the way to his awakening. Because it was a result of that vision that he went and endured 6 years of self-torture. Question, yes. The memories will arise simply as a result of past karma. Now the question is, how do you feed on them? That becomes the sensuality in the present moment. And you've got to watch out for that, because you say, gee, that was really good, that means, well, I want some more of that. That's what it comes down to. So you're setting yourself up for more entrapment. So, okay, that was pleasant, it was nice, but I don't need to feed on that now.
Is passion driven through karma?
Under 33, passion. Passion is raga. Mm-hmm. The word is raga. It's not tanha. It's a question behind you.
I think, like, eating good food, you know, would be like part of sensual pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I tend to go back to the same restaurant over and over because of the food. Mm-hmm. But I don't think about it when I'm not there. Mm-hmm. Would it be a problem?
Not really. The Buddha's talking more about your fascination. Well, I go to this restaurant because there's the atmosphere, and this time I'm going to try that, and let's try this other restaurant over here. And there's just this constant wandering around.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I found as becoming a monk, this was one of the hardest things to give up, was the ability to choose my food. Mm-hmm. And the woman who was the cook at the monastery was an awful cook. I was a better cook than she was. It was very frustrating to see her take really good things that I'd give to her, and she would ruin them. And I realized I've just got to stop thinking about this. I'll eat what I eat, and then as long as the food is healthy, you're okay. Again, the problem is not the sensual pleasure; it's this fascination we have with feeding off of it. And many times, it's not just isn't that a great sensual pleasure, but part of your identity becomes identified with these are the things I like. I'm the kind of person who does this. I'm the kind of look at the personal ads they have. It's all about the sensual pleasures I enjoy, which just defines me. So there's a strong sense of self-definition around that kind of activity.
I have a question about the sensual pleasure. I never thought of food being a sensual pleasure until this talk. Mm-hmm. And now that brings up, well, if I make reservations for a friend to go out to dinner with me, and then I'm looking forward to the food that we're going to eat at this restaurant, mm-hmm. any restaurant, mm-hmm. whichever one I choose, mm-hmm. that we would look forward to. Is that sensual pleasure, looking forward to going out to dinner with that person?
The sensuality is that I'm thinking about, what's that going to be really nice? That's going to be really neat. And you're kind of, getting yourself worked up.
So if you think about the dinner too longingly, that's sensuality.
That's sensuality, yeah. So you make your plans, okay, we'll meet. Okay. And all of a sudden, see, that sounds awfully dry. I don't get to think about it beforehand. I don't get to think about it afterwards. Well, again, it's good to look at actual what you are getting out of that experience without all the elaboration that goes around it. This is what positive psychologists have noticed very much, is that you talk to people about what makes them happy, and they'll say, oh, yes, X makes me happy. And then they'll actually arrange to interview the person while that person is engaged in X. And they'll say, it's not all that happy afterwards, after all. But it's the elaboration beforehand and the elaboration afterwards that we're getting primed to fall for this. There was one positive psychologist was saying, why are people so stupid? And then he thought about himself. He was a mountain climber. And he began to realize that he thought he liked mountain climbing, but he realized while he was climbing the mountain, it was pretty miserable. It was beforehand and afterwards. And so we can talk ourselves into doing some pretty stupid things, the idea that this is actually making me happy. But if you do it without the embroidery, just look at it for what it is, then you find that you're much less, the mind might be willing to give up some of this.
My next question along these lines, now that I'm getting this picture, is the same thing happens for like trips I'm going to take. Half of the enjoyment of the trip is looking forward to the trip. And the other half is actually taking the trip and enjoying it.
And the other half is afterwards.
Well, the other half is afterwards. And that builds on the second, on actually having been there and enjoyed it. But if our goal in life is happiness, mm-hmm. doesn't restricting ourselves to not enjoying and savoring things like that, doesn't that cut down on our happiness?
Well, it means that you're going to have to look elsewhere for your happiness, right? I mean, these are perfections for the sake of awakening. He said, maybe I don't need to have all, if I really look at the happiness I'm getting out of these things, and it's not really as much as I like to tell myself, maybe I better look someplace else for my happiness. That's what the Buddha is saying.
Yes.
He's not trying to say, don't look for happiness, but look for happiness that really is...
in different places.
Look in a different place.
Thank you.
Okay. The passages on sensuality are pretty much self-explanatory. I just wanted to notice that the descriptions of luxury back in the Buddhist time, passage 35, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. Suppose a household or householder's son has a house with a gabled roof, plastered inside and out, draft-free, with close-fitting door and windows shut against the wind. Inside he has a horsehair couch spread with a long fleece coverlet, a white wool coverlet, an embroidered coverlet, a rug of kandali deer hide, a canopy above, and red cushions on either side. And there a lamp would be burning, and his four wives with their many charms would be attending to him. This is luxury in the Buddhist time. And someday someone's going to look back on our luxuries and think the same thing. Question? Traveling mic?
The sensuality, the emphasis on the word, takes me back a bit, because I imagine the anticipation of reading a great book, mm-hmm. of hearing the Dharma talk, mm-hmm. Which isn't, or my sense of jhana doesn't have that bodily sort of pita to it, mm-hmm. but it's just much more sukha. And mm-hmm. so, how is that sensual? How is it?
Okay, looking forward to a good Dharma talk, I would not say it's a sensual pleasure. I mean, you're looking forward to the ideas. You're going to have anticipation. But then you begin to realize, I mean, I don't really need this if I've got an alternative source of pleasure. You go to the Dharma talk without having to get all worked up about it beforehand. You think about it just enough to get you in the car and get you in the room. That's funny.
But it's... that... things like that, or reading a good book, or thinking thoughts, or even meditating, getting, you know, doing a jhana session, is something that one anticipates, clings to.
The way it functions, the way sensuality does. Okay, to cling to it, but it's for the things that are pulling you off the path. You wonder, well, why am I clinging? You do have to hold on to the path while you're practicing. And the anticipation of good meditation sit would not be, would that kind of sensuality? I mean, that's not pleasure. This sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations.
Okay. I was wondering if there was the sixth sense.
We're talking about the five senses.
Oh, okay, so sensuality doesn't apply to the sixth sense.
Again, to the pleasure of jhana, it would not apply.
So that's an alternative. That's your substitute.
That's your substitute.
Oh.
Passage 36, where the Buddha says, when you enter in the first jhana, when you really learn to appreciate the pleasure and rapture, then if perceptions of sensuality come up, you experience them as an affliction. Because you realize, okay, this pleasure is something better. And if I start going back to thinking about sensuality, it is an affliction, it's heavier. You have to be sensitive to that, to appreciate what the Buddha is trying to say here.
Actually, I had a question about that. So does disenchantment and sort of disgust start arising when you see the sensuality and that drives you to want to do jhana practices?
It doesn't necessarily have to be disgust, but just say, geez, this is not satisfactory. This is not enough. I want something better.
Okay. Fed up.
Yeah, you're fed up. And there's a book by John Lee, Frames of Reference, where he's talking about practicing concentration. He starts out with contemplations to give rise to a sense of sangwega, which is a sense of dismay over, gosh, my life has been devoted to things that really don't give satisfaction. And they said, that's really good for getting the mind into concentration because I need an alternative pleasure, an alternative happiness. So. Okay, endurance. Oh, is there a question?
Seclusion?
Yeah, well, there's seclusion would be a sensory pleasure, but it's conducive for the practice. Then you could, then it's okay to be thinking about it and enjoying the thought of it, anticipating it. The word's not saying don't anticipate anything. He's saying, look, where are you putting your hopes for? Where are you going to find your true happiness? You try to be a little bit more discerning and have higher standards for yourself. Okay, two more perfections and we're done. And the teenage kids can wait, okay? Okay, endurance. This word, Pali word, is kanti. It can also be translated as patience or tolerance. This, together with equanimity, is needed for stamina on the path. It's also one of the ways in which you benefit yourself by benefiting others. In other words, if you can develop the ability to endure other people's harsh words, endure other people's mistreatment, and not lash back at them, okay, you're treating them well instead of lashing back at them. And at the same time, you're developing good characters of your own heart, your own character. Okay, when you're practicing endurance, you have to make distinctions as to what should and should not be tolerated based on the principles of karma. The text focused mainly on things that you should tolerate would be harsh words and physical pain. These are the results of old karma. In dealing with harsh words, the Buddha says you have to learn how to depersonalize them so that they don't have the sting that they would have if you say, gee, why is this person mistreating me like that and I don't deserve to be treated like that and I'm miserable? Take the I out of there. The Buddha gives two ways of thinking that way. One is he says, you know, we live in a human world. What are the characteristics of human speech? There are kind words and there are unkind words. There are timely words and there are untimely words. Words spoken with good intentions, words spoken with bad intentions. It goes down the list. In other words, when someone says untrue and untrue, and when people say untrue, harsh, unkind things, this is not out of the ordinary. This is part of the human world. And just to say, okay, I'm not the only person who's experiencing this right now. Think about all the world, people all over the world are being treated this way, and have been treated this way, and will be treated this way. It takes a lot of the personal sting out of these words. That's one way of depersonalizing it. The other way of depersonalizing it is, as the Buddha said, remind yourself, an unpleasant sound has made contact at the ear. Let it stop there, which is what we usually don't do. We bring it in and we elaborate it. We say, why is this person saying this? And why am I being mistreated? If you can just leave it, there's an unpleasant sound at the ear and leave it at that, then you can learn how to tolerate words that otherwise you would not be able to tolerate. And you realize that a lot of what makes it intolerable is what you are doing and sort of bringing this on yourself. All that, the kind of thinking that makes it difficult to stand. And John Mahabua says, he has a statement, he said, when someone says something about you that's got you going for hours afterwards, you know, that breath with which they said it is long gone. And yet it's still reverberating in your mind. So you can't, you know, it's... And sometimes the person who said it's probably forgotten it already, but you're the one who's carrying it around. So it's learn how not to carry it around. And when you're not carrying it around, then you don't find that it's such a heavy weight to bear. But the second thing that you deal with pain... the Buddhists, for learning how to tolerate pain, this comes under the second tetrad in breath meditation. You may have read about the four steps there. There's breathing in and out with a sense of rapture, breathing in and out with a sense of ease, seeing the process of metal fabrication as it's happening, and learning how to calm that metal fabrication. Those are the ways you deal with pain. In other words, you find, is there some part in the body that I can make give a sense of refreshment, sense of rapture around the pain? So I'm not focusing on the pain so much. Secondly, you've got that sense of rapture, sense of ease, well-being in other parts of the body. And then you can look at the process. How does the mind create mental suffering out of a physical pain? And it's the process of verbal and mental fabrication. And particularly, it's the perceptions you're holding around the pain and the things you're telling yourself about the pain. And so you learn how to question those. We could talk for a whole day on different techniques for questioning pain. We'd mentioned a little bit earlier, what is the perception you hold? Is pain a solid thing? Can you learn how to see it as moments of pain? When the moments of pain are there and you can see that, the question is, are they coming at you or are they going away? And one of the perceptions I found very useful is, you think of yourself as like sitting in one of those old station wagons where they had the seat facing back. And as you're riding down the road, whatever comes into your range of vision is going away, going away, going away as soon as you see it. And then you can hold that same perception of the pain. You don't feel that it's coming at you. You're not feeling attacked by the pain. And it arises and goes, rises and goes. If you hold that perception in mind, you find that the pain is a lot easier to bear. Several years back, I was getting a treatment in a Chinese doctor in Singapore. And he had sort of rubbed oil into my back. And then he pulled out these two bamboo whisks, which are basically pieces of bamboo that have been sliced very thin, like that. And then just started beating on me. And my first thought, of course, is, you know, what karma did I do to do this? I deserve this. And then I realized this was going to go on for about half an hour. I better learn how not to suffer from it. And so I developed that perception. As soon as it hits, it's gone. As soon as it hits, going away, going away. And I found I could put up with the pain a lot more easily that way. Well, that's I did not do anything to deserve flogging. This was a legitimate doctor. So, but when you find yourself dealing with physical pain, think of those four steps in the breath meditation. Learn how to breathe with a sense of ease, sense of rapture. Learn how to see, how am I fabricating my perceptions and around this feeling? Can I change the perceptions so that the feeling or pain doesn't have that intense effect on the mind? And that way you find that you can learn how to tolerate and deal with things that otherwise might physically be very hard to bear. So those are the things you have to learn how to tolerate, harsh words and physical pains. The things you don't tolerate are unskillful mind states. An unskillful mind state comes into your mind, you've got to do what you can to get it out. Now this may involve taking time and it may be a delicate process, but your basic attitude is, I can't just let this thing sit here, I've got to learn to question it. And understand, and question why I'm holding on to it. Okay. When we're dealing with endurance, as with equanimity, this is a mind state that's highly affected by the stories you tell yourself. So there's a verbal fabrication that goes in here as well. Particularly the stories yourself about what's happening, why is this happening? And when the Buddha was attacked by that rock that Devadatta rolled down the hill, and Mara comes, and we talked about this yesterday, Mara comes and taunts him. The Buddha says, I'm not sitting here moping, I'm sitting here in sympathy for everybody. So you don't tell yourself, gee, this isn't horrible, I'm sitting here, I can't do anything. Okay, this is my opportunity to practice. This is my opportunity to spread thoughts of goodwill, say when you're sick. There's a passage in the book Joseph and His Brothers by Thomas Mann. Do you know that book? It's one of those big monster books that you should anticipate reading. It's really good. But there's a scene there. You know the story with Joseph. He gets accused of having attacked Potiphar's wife. And there's a scene in the book where Joseph is being taken to the prison, and the boatman who's taking him there sees that Joseph is not upset. He seems to be taking it all very calmly. And the boatman gets upset. You know, you should be upset. You're going to prison. And Joseph says, that's not the story I'm telling myself. This is part of a bigger plan. And this is just a temporary setback in my story, but there's a bigger plan going on. So he changed the story that he was telling about his life, and that made it a lot easier to bear. So if you're telling yourself the story of this person is horrible, I can't stand this person, I can't, and go on and on and on like this, you're the one who's weighing yourself down with your stories. But if you learn how to tell yourself a different story, like, wait, I'm going to get this back in a future lifetime, it's a lot easier to bear with the fact that you're not getting your money back.
Well, and also that it was another gift.
It's another gift, yeah. learn to see it as another gift. Yeah. But learn to tell yourself a different story about what's going on. Okay, that's endurance. Any questions about endurance? Yes. Mike.
Like emotional pain and, let's say, fear, phobia, all kinds of things that...
Yeah, you have to, one, learn how to first breathe around the emotional pain. Look back at how you're breathing around it so I can calm your breathing. And then you put you in a better position where you can ask yourself, what are the stories I'm telling myself about this? Can I change the story?
I have serious phobia and fear towards dogs, okay?
Dogs, mm-hmm.
Then how do I tell myself a different story to get over that?
Okay, in that case, you might want to have some time with really cute little dogs. find the least threatening dog in the least threatening situation.
Mm-hmm.
And be with that dog for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of make a map for yourself from 1 to 10, okay? So you start with something that is very unthreatening and then move up to something that's a little bit more threatening, but you're able to breathe calmly around that and see, okay, this dog doesn't want to bite me. It's just, you know, if I scare the dog might react, but I'll try to do my best not to scare the dog. And then begin to realize that you're actually more in control of the situation than you may have thought. And for to tell your story, it's not that, I mean, there are rabid dogs out there, but I don't think they have any rabid dogs in the Bay Area, right? And so there's no dog that's going around wanting to bite people. And sort of tell your story, you know, get to know dogs a little bit better in unthreatening situations. That's how you do with the phobia.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But generally, with any kind of, you know, really difficult emotional state, it's good to learn how to tell yourself, breathe calmly, and then ask yourself, what stories am I telling about this? Can I change the story? What perceptions am I holding in mind? And as for the dog, have you been bitten by dogs?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but lots of goodwill to those bad dogs. Anything else about endurance? Okay, we have 5 minutes for equanimity. Okay. Basically, this too has to be regarded in line with the principles of karma. And the first lesson you have to learn is past bygones have to be past bygones. And the big one, of course, you have to deal with is grief over a personal loss. And the Buddha talking about grief, Manta King Basenity. King Basenity is talking to the Buddha. Word comes to him that his favorite queen has died, and he breaks down. And the Buddha basically says, on the one hand, he says, try to depersonalize it. He doesn't use those words, but he says, since when has there ever been a case that people don't die? It's going to happen. This is a natural thing all over the world. So you think of the larger picture to begin with. And then he goes on to say, okay, to whatever extent you find that expressing your grief is serving a purpose, go ahead and do it. Don't feel that as a Buddhist you have to hold it in. And whatever expression you have, the eulogies for the person who passed away, expression of how much you miss the person. There will, however, come a time when you realize that your expression of grief is actually harming you. And that's the time you have to learn how to say enough.
Grief is somanasa.
Soka, somanasa, it can be any kind of, you know, sorrow or sadness.
So, but it was the word somana, domanasa.
Yeah. And, it's interesting, there are two passages in the Tarigata where nuns talk about how they had lost their children and the Buddha comes and speaks to them. One is, this one woman has lost a son and he tells her, you don't know the path of his coming or going, this being who has come here from where? The one you lament as my son. But when you know the path of his coming or going, you don't grieve after him, for that is the nature of beings. Unasked, he came from there. Without permission, he went from here. Coming from where? Having stayed a few days. and coming one way from here, he goes yet another from there. Dying in the human form, he'll go wandering on. As he came here, so he's gone. So what is there to lament? In other words, this is a person, a total stranger comes into your life and it goes off as a total stranger. Begin to realize that that connection you had is not quite as intense or total as the son you're having now was somebody else's son before and will be somebody else's son again. Another one. Jiva, my daughter, you cry in the woods. Come to your senses, Ubud. 84,000 people, all named Jiva, have been buried in that charnel ground. For which of them do you grieve? Again, thinking about the fact of death as being just universal. It takes some of the personal sting out. When the Buddha talks about the fact that it's going to be hard to meet someone who has never been your mother or your father or your brother or your sister or your son or your daughter, it's not a teaching on how to have goodwill for everybody. It's a teaching on dismay. That you realize that you've lost that many brothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and sons and daughters over and over and over again. And so the question is, I'm going to find a way out. So again, he's not saying you have to feel equanimity there, but equanimity is possible even in a case like that. The other issue in terms of karma that you have to deal with in equanimity is, what are the results of taking an equanimous attitude? He says there are some times when equanimity should be developed and other times when it should not be developed. Just sort of sitting there and seeing something horrible happening in front of you, you don't just say, oh, that's just the karma beings. If you can stop it, you stop it. That's not a time for equanimity. It's when something is beyond your power to help, that's when you have to have equanimity. So you can focus your energies on areas where you can be of help. So this is why we develop equanimity, not so you just get indifferent to things. It's when you learn, it's for the purpose of focusing your energies on areas where it will be a benefit. When you have duties that get in the way of what you want, okay, you have to develop equanimity for that. I've got this duty that has to put my other desires on hold. And the Buddha's not telling you you don't have an attachment to the people you love. And the attachment to your parents, your children is something that is normal. But the question is, how much do you have to feed off of that attachment? To what extent does your happiness totally depend on that attachment? And that's where you've got to learn how to train yourself to say, I've got to learn to have an attitude that, okay, I'm attached to this person, but if the person had to go, I could still function, I could still live in this life. I don't need this person in order to be happy. And this is why, one of the reasons why we practice meditation, so you have that internal resource that you can draw on. That's equanimity in daily life. As for equanimity in meditation, there are times when it is unskillful. The Buddha says you have to balance concentration, persistence, and equanimity as you practice. There are times, if you were just equanimous, your concentration would never develop. You've got to work on getting the mind concentrated sometimes, which requires persistence. If you're just putting a lot of effort in, you get restless. That's when you have to learn more concentration and equanimity. If you just sit there concentrating without trying to go to higher states, you're being lazy. So you have to balance these different qualities in your mind, even as you practice meditation. The issue about why equanimity is not the goal is because there can still be feeding off of the equanimity. You can get a really nice state of concentration, and you're still feeding off of that. And wherever there's feeding, even if it's something relatively pleasant and stable, there's going to be stress. So equanimity is one of the factors we develop, but it is not the goal. And the Buddha talks about levels of equanimity. There's equanimity based on diversity or multiplicity. Let's say multiplicity. Diversity has other meanings. Multiplicity, in other words, when you make up your mind that whatever happens, I'm just not going to react. And then there's equanimity that's based on your concentration, which is much stronger. That's equanimity based on unity. When you've got the singleness of mind. And that is much stronger than the equanimity that comes from just, I'm just going to not react out of force of will. I mean, it's kind of a poker face that you have to take in, a poker mind that you have to develop in things. But the best poker mind is the one that's based on a state of concentration, because that has a much more solid foundation. So those are the main things about equanimity. Any questions? Yes.
So, you've referred today and yesterday also to feeding off of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that is feeding off of something, does that mean you're basing your happiness on it?
Right.
So something can come along and you can enjoy it, but then if it leaves, you weren't trying to be happy based on that enjoyment.
There'll probably be some feeding in there, but you have to look at, is this the kind of feeding that I would just, I'd get my fangs out if they try to take it away from me, or is it okay?
Okay.
And then secondly, by enjoying this thing, what kind of states of mind are being developed?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Question here.
So equanimity based on multiplicity, as you said, is just force of will, sheer force of will, keep away from maybe sensual thoughts or whatever it is. Is that something like the fifth mode of destroying thoughts that we discussed in the beginning, the five ways to deal with thoughts?
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to be that fifth one, but I'm just not going to go there. That would be ignoring the issue.
Okay. So essentially all those techniques that are there for just getting into first jhana is still only equanimity based on multiplicity?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So equanimity based on singleness or unity, yeah, that's the fourth jhana.
Yeah, in this text that it says actually the formless jhanas, but
formless jhana.
You've got the fourth jhana, but it should also apply.
Okay.
So the Buddha is very clear about stream entry and what happens after that. Does he make mention of nearing stream entry and the momentum that beings pick up to, you know, encourage them? Well, if you're headed...
The problem is if he described it, everybody would try to clone it. We had an old Air Force general. He'd been in the Korean War. He'd killed a lot of people in the Korean War, and he wanted to make sure he didn't go to hell. So after he came back, he really got into meditation. And he ended up building a little hut for himself to meditate at the monastery. And there was one time when John Fuang was away. And I came back from my alms round. He came up to me in front of the dining room. Last night was really big. It was this step. And he had it all mapped out, but what comes right before stream entry. I've only got two steps to go. And I said, I'm happy for you, but I really need to eat my meal right now. Thank you. And then the next day, it was one step, you know. And the next day, John Fuang came back from Bangkok. And as I was, what I would usually do when he came back from Bangkok, I would unpack his little bag, and he'd kind of tell me things that happened in Bangkok and ask me what was happening there at the monastery. And I said, Chode, which was the name of the general, seems to be going off his rocker. He thinks he's on the verge of stream entry. He's only got one more step. And John Fung's response was interesting. He said, you didn't try to argue with him, did you? I said, no. He said, good, because if you're not really his teacher 100%, the more you argue with someone who makes a claim like that, the more they get entrenched. So you're just going to leave them. And then he told the story about a John Munn, when people had been practicing off in the woods, in the caves on their own, and thought they'd attained, you know, arahantship or something like that. They'd come and see a John Munn. And John Munn wouldn't say anything. He just said, well, just stay around here for the time being. And usually just kind of staying in his presence for two or three days, kind of calm them down, and they realize, okay, they made a mistake. And just after he finished saying that, Chode comes running up the stairs to report his verge. You know. And I don't know if he heard the last statement or not, but he heard enough to say, I've been a fool. And he bowed down to John Fuang. is, okay, that's a case of a real student-teacher relationship, and you don't have to say that much. The student will back off. So I think it's wise the Buddha doesn't describe a lot of these things in too much detail, because then we try to clone them. Yes.
Tangentially, yesterday you were talking about the mind.
There we go. Yesterday, I was listening to yesterday's last night, and a lot about Moon and Lee and
Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Lee.
Ajahn Lee, yes. acknowledging that monastics cannot discuss attainments, especially their own. But from your experience in Thailand, is the general sense among informed people that Ajahn Lee and or Phuang were arahant?
They were noble disciples.
No, Arya.
Noble disciples, not necessarily arahants, but noble disciples.
What does that mean?
You can either be stream enderer, once return, or non return, or arahant. There are four stages.
Arya, a noble Arya. Person. Yeah. Like some people say Cha or
Ajahn
Sayadaw or Mahasi was, you know, talk like that in Thailand.
Among the monks, they talk about it. Of course, the gossip then spreads out, but that's what it is, it's gossip.
Okay.
You don't really know. The Buddha said you can't really judge someone else's attainment.
In Burma, you get a certificate, can't you?
I'm not responsible for Burma, okay. what I can tell you is there's, apparently Ajahn Mahabhu had made the comment about Ajahn Sawat, the Abhidhamma Metta, that he was an arahant. And there was one day when Ajahn Sawat said to me, you know, when Ajahn Mahabhu said that, I wasn't yet an arahant. Which made you stop and think, you know, all these, you know, certified, whatever. You don't really know 100%. And your business is, what is your attainment? You focus on that. You find people you find inspiring, you learn from them, but still, the work is inside. I think this is one of the meaning of, you know, the question, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the answer is no. Why is it no? Because you're looking in the wrong place. If you want to see awakening, you have to look inside.
That came up yesterday in listening to it, because those stories you tell about them are so profoundly inspiring, mm-hmm. that this person was really there. Yeah. He was really onto something.
I mean, I have my beliefs about the attainments about some of these people, but I can't 100% guarantee them. Anything else? Yes.
So, more of an overview question. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to teach or to convey your sense of the perfections in this list form versus the normal one that mm-hmm. we learn, which starts with generosity, virtue, mm-hmm. da, da, da?
Because the list, as they have it, really it's not a progressive list.
And my sense of what you meant by progressive is that quality of determination, discernment, is that
well, progressive, what makes you might start, it starts out with giving and virtue,
right,
which sounds
exactly.
like it's starting a basic stuff, but then it kind of moves up and moves down, back and forth and around. And so one perfect question for the end of the day.
Yes.
One is that realizing that all the perfections do come under the perfection of determination, because there's something you have to make up your mind you're going to do. And then when you think of making up your mind you're going to do this, what are the qualities you need? And as the Buddha said, you need discernment, truth, relinquishment, and calm. And then all the perfections come under those headings. And I thought that would be a useful way of seeing them. Also, putting together the ones that work together, like putting discernment together with goodwill, because that underlies the whole rest of why you make the determination to begin with.
Right.
Truth, putting truth together with virtue and persistence, those qualities tend to reinforce one another. The same with renunciation and giving, and the same with equanimity and endurance. It's good to group them like this because they make sense together.
It's true, though, it seems from the way you've taught this, is that discernment,
is the
skillful, unskillful, fundamentally
right. mm-hmm.
is the name of the game,
right?
Mm-hmm. In terms of the practice. Mm-hmm. But the refrain that I woke up with is in terms of the feel of this lecture the day before and today also, is that the refrain was, you've got to be smart about it. Mm-hmm. Like it's a process of discernment related to sort of a smartness.
Well, it can be street smarts, smarts.
And that's, it's like I'm given two buttons. Mm-hmm. There's two buttons always. Mm-hmm. And it's in a shifting sort of field. And I'm developing this intelligence to hit the right button.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In this constantly shifting, moving field. Mm-hmm. And the practice is sort of the cultivation of that type of awareness to hit that button in this.
And the teachings give you kind of a framework so that you're not constantly shift around by the shifting field, that you have a sense of your purpose and where you want to go. Because I said, you know, awakening is not everybody's guaranteed goal, but you have to make your mind, this is where I want to go. I want a happiness that's harmless, happiness that's true. This is how you do it. And so when you're faced with choices in life, you try to keep these qualities in mind. Or this choice I'm going to make, is it going to develop these qualities or is it going to hamper them? And it gives you kind of a measuring stick.
So my last question is, do we lose something when we translate pāna as discernment versus wisdom? And is, mm-hmm. is something lost in that?
There may be a loss, but I think there's a lot of gain. Because you tell somebody, you know, develop your wisdom, and you say, I don't have any wisdom. But it's asking you to look back, okay, where do you already have some discernment? Can you apply that ability to discern things in this field, in this field as well? And that was precisely the conversation I had with the John Fung that made me change my way of translating the word. He once said, use your banya. And he said, I don't have any banya. And he said, if you didn't have any banya, you wouldn't be a human being, you know. And I can think of a lot of human beings who don't have any wisdom at all, but we have some discernment about things.
Right.
So you work on that and you build on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Comes right out of that question, which is the power of judgment, your essay. Mm-hmm. We're 99.9%, we're deluded, so we need guidance, we need people. To judge it, like yesterday, it's discernment. How can you know that it's the right discernment? But is there a point, like, also that Dhammapada, whatever it is, your reference to yourself, that you are your reference, the Dhamma is your reference, equating the two. Is there a point, like, for instance, is stream entry, whatever you call it, sotapatti, a point where you're self-reliant, where you don't need this external help?
After that experience, I mean, you know what the path is, you know what the goal is at that point. Now, you still have some issues that you're going to have worked out. You haven't fully mastered concentration yet, you haven't fully mastered your discernment yet, but you've had the experience that guarantees, okay, this is the right path, because you've seen the deathless. And at the same time, you realize that, okay, this path that I'm following is the path that leads there, the Buddha knew what he's talking about. And you've gotten a sense of the path at that point.
So you could get, for instance, I look at the world today, and there's so few qualified monastic teachers, mm-hmm. and everyone needs this guidance. They need someone to say you're going off the cliff. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare to get that guidance. Mm-hmm. But is there a point where you don't need it anymore?
After stream entry, you're safer.
Well, let's do it.
Okay. So, thank you for your attention. Okay. Hope this has been helpful.